Well, Jesus is on trial. He's been arrested and he's been on trial before the religious leaders. And today we're going to see him go to the next step of being on trial before the political leaders, before the Romans, before the ones who were the only ones who had the power to execute him, which is what the religious leaders wanted. Now, I guess one question that kind of pops up is how could things get so bad? You know, he's only been around for 2 to 3 years is the length of his ministry here. And he was so popular, but how could the Jewish leadership turn so strongly against him? Well, there's a lot of reasons, but the biggest reason is truly the reason that the Jewish leaders saw themselves there, and that was the defenders of the faith. Okay? We see that this started to become a problem for them even very early in Jesus' ministry. Go back to Mark chapter 2, right at the beginning of his ministry, and look at this one story, but we can pull out many other examples like this, but you can see this example for example. Starting in verse 5, when Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralytic, "Son, your sins are forgiven." Now some teachers of the law were sitting there thinking to themselves, "Why does this fellow talk like that? He's blaspheming. Who can forgive sins but God alone?" Very early in Jesus' ministry, it started to become very clear to those who were in the know, those who were studied of God's Word, those who studied the Scriptures, that what Jesus was doing, what Jesus was saying, what Jesus was claiming was that He was God. Even something simple like Jesus forgiving this paralytic sins, it was very clear to them that there's no way anybody can forgive somebody else's sins unless they've sinned against them. And this paralytic has never met Jesus. How could Jesus forgive his sins? The sins that this guy has are against God. Only God can forgive sins. And they saw Jesus claiming to be God. That's what struck things up. Now that was Jewish leaders. What about regular Jews? Did other Jews besides the leaders have trouble with Jesus' claims? John 6, verse 60. On hearing it, many of his disciples said, "This is a hard teaching. Who can accept it?" Aware that his disciples were grumbling about this, Jesus said to them, "Does this offend you? What if you see the Son of Man ascend to where he was before? The Spirit gives life, the flesh counts for nothing. The words I have spoken to you are spirit and they are life. Yet there are some of you who do not believe. For Jesus had known from the beginning which of them did not believe and who would betray him." He went on to say, "This is why I told you that no one can come to me unless the Father has enabled him." From this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. Here we see regular people, disciples, people who were following Jesus, people who believed in Jesus, people who looked to Jesus as their rabbi, as their leader. When they started realizing what the Jewish leaders had realized earlier, that Jesus was actually claiming to be God, they had trouble with it. They said, "This is a hard teaching. Who can accept this?" Okay? You know, just look at some of the stuff that he says in there. We skip some verses that were preceding it where he kind of makes this point. But he says, "What if you see the Son of Man to ascend to where he was before?" Well, that's getting pretty clear there, right? "No one can come to me unless the Father has enabled him." So they're starting to realize it, and here you see people start to fall away from Jesus because they just cannot accept that Jesus is God. And you know, that's the bottom line of Christianity. That's what our faith is all about. Is if Jesus were not God, well then what does our faith mean? C.S. Lewis, I love the way he put it, and you've probably heard this before. Here's you a quote out of his book called Mere Christianity. He says, "A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher." And you think about it, so many people say, people of other faiths say, oh, you know, the Muslims and others say, oh, he was a great moral teacher. You know, kind of like Buddha or Muhammad or whatever. Well, C.S. Lewis says, you could not accept that. You cannot call Jesus a great moral teacher. Because he would either be a lunatic on the level with a man who says that he's a poached egg, or he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. I can't put it any better than that. Jesus did claim to be God. You either have to accept that he was God, or he was a fool, or a lunatic, or a madman trying to deceive people. You've got to make your choice. And the Jewish leaders, what did they decide? How did they understand that? And when they looked and saw so many people flocking to Jesus, what were their thoughts of that? Well, going on in John, the next chapter, starting at verse 45. Finally, the temple guards went back to the chief priests and Pharisees, who asked them, "Why didn't you bring him in?" "Well, no one ever spoke the way this man does," the guards declared. "You mean he's deceived you also?" the Pharisees retorted. "Has any of the rulers of the Pharisees believed in him? No. But this mob that knows nothing of the law, there's a curse on them." They saw Jesus as a master deceiver. They didn't believe that he could be the Son of God. That was not an option that they gave themselves. They also probably didn't see him as a lunatic, because he spoke very wisely. They tried to make him look like a lunatic, but that never worked. So he obviously was a devil of hell. Okay? He is obviously a son of Satan, not a son of God. And they accused him of that. So here you see that they saw him as a master deceiver. And the crowd, who's totally ignorant, you know, too ignorant, too uneducated to be able to know any better, that's why they flocked to him. That was their view. So how did these leaders, and not just leaders, but devout Jews, how did they react to Jesus' continued claims to be God? Going on, chapter 10, verse 24. The Jews gathered around him, saying, "How long will you keep us in suspense? If you're the Christ, tell us plainly." Jesus answered, "I did tell you, but you did not believe. The miracles I do in my Father's name speak for me." And then verse 30, "I and the Father are one." Again, the Jews picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus said to him, "I've shown you many great miracles from the Father. For which of these do you stone me?" "We're not stoning you for any of these," replied the Jews, "but for blasphemy, because you, a mere man, claim to be God." Here we see a group of just devout Jews. Okay, we don't see that they're the Jewish leaders or any of that. They're talking to Jesus, and Jesus is making it clear that he is claiming to be God. They understand that. And what's their reaction? They want to kill him. They want to kill him by stoning. Why would they want to do that? Well, not because of the miracles, they said, but because of blasphemy. He's claiming to be God. Well, is that an appropriate reaction, picking up stones to try to kill somebody by throwing rocks at them? Well, look back at Leviticus chapter 24, verse 13. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Take the blasphemer outside the camp. All those who heard him are to lay their hands on his head, and the entire assembly is to stone him. Say to the Israelites, if anyone curses his God, he will be held responsible. Anyone who blasphemes the name of the Lord must be put to death. The entire assembly must stone him. Whether he's an alien or native born, when he blasphemes the name, he must be put to death." Okay? Anyone who blasphemed God was to be executed by stoning. God made it very clear that was the penalty for someone cursing God, claiming to be God. If you claim to be God, you're cursing God because you're putting him down on our level. Okay? So it was the right response. It was the correct response for someone who's blaspheming. And these people truly believed that Jesus was not God. That was the error, is not recognizing Jesus as God, not accepting that Jesus was God. And if you look at that, if you didn't believe Jesus was God, and he went around claiming to be God like he did, the right thing to do would be to have him executed, right? That's what God prescribed. C.S. Lewis put another place in Mere Christianity, kind of put it the same way. He says, one man said to me, 300 years ago, people in England were putting witches to death. Now, was that what you call the rule of human nature or right conduct? But surely the reason we don't execute witches is that we don't believe there are such things. If we did, if we really thought that there were people going about who had sold themselves to the devil and received supernatural powers from him in return, and were using these powers to kill their neighbors or drive them mad or bring bad weather, surely we would all agree that if anyone deserved the death penalty, then these filthy quislings did. Right? If witches were real, if you truly believe witches were real and that these people were doing this, then putting witches on trial, executing witches would make sense, right? We don't understand the witch trials and the witch hangings and all that because we don't believe witches are real. But those people back in those days did. So it was a natural response. We believe Jesus is God. And it was a horrible thing for the people back in Jesus' day to execute him. But they didn't believe he was God. And yet he claimed to be God. And the right reaction for them was to execute him. Their big problem was not recognizing Jesus as God. So that was the big thing. But there were other things. There were a lot of things that really forced them to move. You know, where people just naturally that zealous for their God to that would react wanting to kill a blasphemer. Well, we've seen some verses where that's the case to a degree. But what really got things to the deep level that the Jewish leadership just couldn't think of anything else but shutting him up and getting him out. Well, Jesus added some fuel to the fire. Matthew 21, verse 45, for example. When the chief priests and the Pharisees heard Jesus' parables, they knew he was talking about them. They looked for a way to arrest him, but they were afraid of the crowd because the people held that he was a prophet. Jesus made it personal to the leaders. He pointed out their failures. He pointed out their hypocrisy. He pointed out that they were not good examples of what God wants in his people. That's what the leaders were supposed to be, as examples and guides and to guide the people into the truth, into God's truths. And Jesus pointed out that they did a horrible job of that. All right, what else did Jesus do to personally offend the top Jewish leadership? Mark 11, verse 15. On reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple area and began driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. And as he taught them, he said, "Is it not written, 'My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations'? But you have made it a den of robbers." The chief priests and teachers of the law heard this and they began looking for a way to kill them, for they feared him because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. Okay, he did this early in his ministry, and that we didn't see a strong of a reaction because they didn't know who he was at the time. They asked him for authority and all that. Here we see at the end of his ministry he does it, and that's not the straw that breaks a camel's back. That's a big thing that breaks a camel's back. Because this is straight in their face to the Jewish leadership. This marketplace, we've talked about this before, in the temple courts was known as the Bazaars of Annas. Why? Well, Annas, who was the guy with all the power, the head Jew with all the power, he owned all that. And when Jesus cleared the money changers and the dove sellers and the whole marketplace from the temple, he was attacking Annas' business. He was attacking, and he was saying that Annas was doing evil in God's house in front of all these people. If you were Annas, how would you react? If you had great power like Annas, how would you react? Well, we see that's what they did. Another thing, one further thing. What else did further motivated the leadership to try to stop Jesus? John 11, 43 to 48. When he had said this, Jesus called out in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped in strips of linen and a cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the grave clothes and let him go." Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their faith in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing? They asked. Here's this man performing many, many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. They were concerned about Jesus' growing popularity, the people who followed him, the numbers who followed him. And it really got worse there at the very end after Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. Because that happened in a suburb right outside Jerusalem, in Bethany. And lots of people from Jerusalem were there. And people who were not there heard about it and came to see. And everyone knew Lazarus had died. But yet now he was alive. We had walking proof that Jesus had this great power of God. So much was this a problem that not only were the Jewish leaders trying to get rid of Jesus, but they thought that, we'll see later, or we saw later in the chapter, they decided they needed to get rid of Lazarus because he was a walking proof of Jesus' power. But on top of this, what concerns them is not only are people going to their enemy and Jesus is becoming more popular, but you know, as more and more people do this, we're talking thousands. What great power Jesus has when he has thousands of followers, right? What do the Romans think about if they saw somebody who has this great power? They could be concerned about a coup or an insurrection, about a revolution. In fact, after Jesus fed the 5,000, that was 5,000 men plus women and children, those people looked up and they saw, hey, we've got so much support here. This guy's obviously the Messiah, the one who's going to bring Israel to greatness. Let's form an army and go fight the Romans. They wanted to make Jesus king right then and there. Romans catch word of that. What happens? Well, the Romans will come down hard. They don't think about it. They don't discuss it. They don't negotiate. They don't compromise. They come down hard. And the Jewish leaders knew that. The Jewish leadership had a fair amount of power that the Romans graciously gave them. They would lose that power because they are obviously not in control of their people if they let something like this get out of hand. Okay? They could lose not only their power, but their standing. They could be enemies of the state. You know, so they were concerned. And if we let them go on like this, they said, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. So they were concerned about national security. They were concerned about the well-being of themselves, most importantly, but also their way of life and Israel. So again, if you put yourself in the shoes of these Jewish leaders, if you truly believe that Jesus was not the Son of God, was not the Messiah, what other reaction is there? So, they had this meeting of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was the top 70 elders, the leadership, the top leadership of the Jews. Okay? And they said, we've got to do something about this. So what did they decide to do about this threat? Going on. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You don't realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. look at the double meaning of that and how powerful the meaning is. In fact, John points out, he says he didn't say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. And not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God to bring them together and make them one. So from that time on, from that day on, they plotted to take his life. So they decided, the conclusion of this meeting of the Sanhedrin was they had to shut Jesus up permanently. They had to get him out of the picture. They had to execute him. Okay? So if that's what they needed to do, and it was clear they needed to do that, why didn't they just do it? They had the power. Why didn't they just do it? Go back to Matthew 26, starting at verse 3. Then the chief priests and the elders of the people assembled in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas. And they plotted to arrest Jesus in some sly way and kill him. But not during the feast, they said, or there may be a riot among the people. So why didn't they do it right then? Well, right then happened to be the Feast of Unleavened Bread, one of the big festivals of the Jews. And there were Jews from all over the world in Jerusalem, and many of them supported Jesus. And Jesus had tons of people flocking to him. They couldn't just go and arrest him. Okay, we've talked about this before. The people would stand up and defend Jesus. The people would oppose the Jewish leadership for going against Jesus. Okay? So they decided, let's just wait. We've got another week of this. Okay? The Feast of Unleavened Bread was the 7-day long feast. So they'd wait another week. They've waited a couple years now already. They'd wait until after the Feast of Unleavened Bread when people went home, and then they would arrest them. Okay? So that they wouldn't potentially spark a riot. Well, we know the story. They didn't wait, did they? Why not? Well, going on, verse 14. Then one of the 12, the one called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and asked, "What are you willing to give me if I hand him over to you?" So they counted out for him 30 silver coins. From then on, Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. They got an insider. Okay? They got someone on the inside who offered to turn him over, to let them find him and get to him in some secret place or some secluded place where the people weren't around and be able to take care of it. You know, at this time they were maybe even still waiting, you know, thinking that they'd wait until after the feast, and having an insider there who would make sure that he didn't get away, that wherever he went or whatever happened afterwards, this insider could take him to him. But they had an insider. And that opportunity came a little sooner than they expected. When did they take advantage of this opportunity? John 13 and 18. 13 verses 1 to 2. It was just before the Passover feast. Okay? And a lot of times when they talk about the Passover feast, they're not just talking about Passover day and the feast that goes with that. But Passover day was the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. So it was just before that feast, whether it was just before the Passover day, just before the week of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. You know, it says it was just before that. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. And then verse 2, the evening meal was already being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. So we see there the evening meal, the Passover meal was being served. And then chapter 18, verse 12. Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him. And I've given you a few verses in Luke that you can see a little bit more of the progress, but we've talked about this. We've looked at the story. But it was the night of the Passover feast. The first night of the Feast of Unleavened Bread was when it all came to a head. Okay, this is the night where everybody in Jerusalem was in a home. They were somewhere celebrating the Passover feast. It was actually a good time not to run into the public when they went to capture Jesus. And you see, this great holy night, this great feast night, it was more important to them to catch Jesus than it was to celebrate that feast. We kind of get the idea later in some verses that are mentioned that some of them hadn't even gotten around to eating the Passover meal by this time. But whether they had or not, you see that they left their homes, they left their families, because this was more important, and they spent all night, without going to bed, without sleeping, trying to take care of this problem, because they had the opportunity. This opportunity came. Okay? 2 weeks ago, we saw the religious trials, the trials before the religious leaders. Let's recap those real quickly here. When Jesus was arrested, where did they take him? Next verses, starting verse 13. They bound him and brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it would be good if one man died for the people. That was a verse that we read earlier. So they took him to Annas, the father-in-law of the high priest Caiaphas. Well, why did they do that? Caiaphas is the high priest. He's the one in charge. Why didn't they take him to Caiaphas? Why did they take him to Annas instead? Well, we looked at a couple of verses with this a couple of weeks ago, but let's just remind ourselves. Luke 3, verse 2, this is when it's talking about the time that John the Baptist came. It says, it was during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas that the word of God came to John, the son of Zechariah, in the desert. And you'll see a similar sort of verse in Acts 4, verse 6. Well, there was only one high priest. But that verse says it was during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. Okay? Now, we know from historical records that Annas was high priest until 6 A.D. So, how could he be high priest now? Well, he wasn't. Caiaphas was the high priest. Okay? The Romans deposed Annas in 6 A.D., but he found it more important to retain the control and the power than it was to be the high priest himself. So he made sure, because the Romans kind of auctioned it off to the highest bidder, who would get to be the high priest. And he had the resources to be able to make sure that that high priesthood stayed in his family. He made sure each of his sons became high priest. His son-in-law, Caiaphas, became high priest. Even a grandson became high priest, while he really retained the power for the whole time. Okay? And even the Jews themselves considered Annas to be the high priest, because a high priesthood was supposed to be something that was appointed by God, not by Romans, and it was supposed to be for life. So they considered Annas as the high priest. So they took Jesus not to the high priest, but rather to the one who really had the power. They took him to Annas. Now, Annas, what does Annas want? Annas wants to get rid of Jesus, right? He's had some personal attacks by Jesus. This whole thing in the marketplace, throwing the marketplace out of the temple, was an attack on a big part of Annas' power and his wealth. And his son-in-law was on the same boat. His son-in-law, Caiaphas, it said in that verse, was the one who had advised the Jews that it would be better for one man to die for the people, right? So, was Annas able... What they have to do now, they've got him. They know what they need to do with him. They need to execute him. So now all they need is an excuse, right? They have to have a convictable confession or a convictable reason to have him executed, right? Well, this is Passover feast night, so it's late at night, after midnight most likely, 1 or 2 in the morning, who knows. We're not given all the details, but you would imagine the whole Sanhedrin's not there, okay? Judas left the Last Supper when Jesus said, what you're going to do, go do quickly. He went and brought them, and so during this time they've been gathering, going house to house to the Sanhedrin members, the Jewish leaders, and gathering the leadership together. While they were waiting for that to happen is when Jesus was before Annas. So was Annas able to get a convictable confession while the Sanhedrin was being gathered? Verse 19. Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. I've spoken openly to the world, Jesus replied. I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews came together. I never said anything in secret. Okay. So Jesus didn't offer anything. In fact, he said, you know what I've said. I've always spoken openly. I've had no secrets. Well, Annas kept trying. What did he finally do when it became obvious that he wouldn't get anything out of Jesus? Verse 24. Then Annas sent him, still bound, to Caiaphas, the high priest. Okay? Sent him to Caiaphas. Annas knows what he wants to have happen. You know what? This is a good little test for Caiaphas. Okay, Caiaphas, you make sure that whatever you need to do, get rid of this guy. Okay, he knows Caiaphas wants to get rid of him too, so he lets Caiaphas do the dirty work and passes Jesus on to Caiaphas. All right. Well, now Caiaphas is together with a lot of the Jewish leaders that have been rounded up. They've been wanting to get rid of Jesus for months. They've had months to prepare for this. So, with months to prepare, did the Jewish leaders have a solid case against Jesus? Mark 14, starting at verse 55. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. but they didn't find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. You'd think with months they would have it all nailed down, but they don't. Instead, they look for false witness. They look for someone to come up, and you know, as we've talked a couple of weeks ago about how this was an illegal trial in almost every way. And here, they're trying to find two witnesses who agree, because that's one of the tenets, is unless two witnesses agree on something, then you don't have a truth. Well, they didn't care about the truth. And they didn't care if these witnesses that came before them were good witnesses or not. In fact, they weren't. And even despite all that, they couldn't find two who would agree on something. Were they ever able to find two who would agree on some incriminating evidence? Well, next verses we see, then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. We heard him say, I will destroy this man-made temple, and in 3 days I'll build another, not made by man. Yet even their testimony did not agree. So we had a time where a couple of them agreed on something, but they really didn't agree. And what they were agreeing about is not something Jesus said. And we've looked at that before. Jesus said, you destroy this temple, and I will raise it up in 3 days. He didn't threaten to destroy the temple, and they knew that too. And in fact, it wasn't even that temple that he was talking about. He was talking about his body, that temple. Well, Caiaphas knew that that's not what Jesus had said. He also knew that that twisted evidence really is not going to stand up before the Romans, because the Romans are the ones who have the ability to execute people. The Sanhedrin did not. So he needed to get something better. So what did he then try? Matthew 26, verse 62. Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. He directly asked Jesus if he was the Messiah, the Son of God. Jesus would not defend himself, because defending himself was not what was to be done at this time, right? This was all part of God's plan for Jesus to go to the cross and for it to play out like this. So he didn't try to defend himself. Instead, he sat there silent until the chief priest forced him to speak. He said, I charge you under oath by the living God, and in the name of the living God, are you the Christ? Are you the Son of God? Well, Jesus has to answer. How does Jesus answer? And he answers in a way that's even deeper than what Caiaphas and the others expected. Next verse. Yes, it is as you say, Jesus replied. But I say to all of you, in the future, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. Jesus says, yes, I am the Son of God. I am the Messiah. You said it, and that's what it is, and you will see proof when I return on God's right hand. What's he saying here? He is saying everything that they were trying to get him to imply. But here he flat out says it. He is God. He is the Messiah. He is the Christ. He is the Son of Man who's going to be on God's right hand. If they didn't believe that Jesus was the Christ, what is that? That's blasphemy, right? Look at this, verse 65. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, he's spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look now, you've heard the blasphemy. What do you think? He's worthy of death, they answered. We've got our evidence now. We've got not just two witnesses, we've got this whole body of the Sanhedrin and all these Jewish leaders. Everyone who's here are witnesses to his blasphemy. And here you see the high priest tore his clothes, which was one of those things that was forbidden. The high priest was never to do that. And that's just kind of part of that illegal trial stuff there. But they had plenty of witnesses now. So now, they knew what they wanted to do with him. They wanted to shut him up permanently. They needed a reason. Now they've got a reason. Now they've got a very bold reason. Jesus very clearly stated that he is God. Now they've got that. What do they need to do next? Well, now what's interesting is that although these religious trials were not legal, they didn't follow their own rules of how to conduct religious trials. You see these little snippets of where they, where it's kind of convenient, they try to retain some semblance of legality. You know, by them looking for two witnesses who would agree on something. Another thing they do, we see in Luke chapter 22, verse 66, it's kind of interesting. It says, at daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. Okay? They've had all these questionings. You had the questionings before Annas, you had the questionings before Caiaphas, when the bulk of the Sanhedrin, whoever was there, but now they wait till daybreak. Okay, we don't know how long they waited, but they wait until daybreak because no trial is supposed to happen at nighttime. Okay, so they wait till daybreak. They've got all the Sanhedrin and all the chief people, the leaders there, and they hold this quote unquote official kangaroo court here. Okay, this official trial. Matthew 27:1 says that he was sentenced early in the morning, and that corresponds with this verse here in Luke. Okay. So they have the judgment of he's guilty of blasphemy, and the penalty for that is death by stoning. So why don't they just do it? Because they can't. The Jewish leaders used to have the right to execute until just a few years before. Until 30 AD, the Sanhedrin could execute people. So if this all happened a few years before, we wouldn't have Jesus crucified. He'd have been stoned to death for blasphemy, right? But in 30 AD, the Romans took away that right. Okay? And they said, only the Roman government has the power to execute. How did the Romans execute? During this short period of time, there was a short window of time where the method of execution that they used was this horrible form, one of the worst forms and most tortuous forms of execution, and that was crucifixion. And crucifixion, by the way, which we'll see next week, because we're going to talk about the crucifixion of Jesus next week. Crucifixion is the only kind of execution that is known to man that fits the messianic prophecies of how the Messiah would die. And we'll look deeper at that next week. So we see this was all part of God's plan, and you see God's perfect timing. Okay? This had just happened a few years before, it would have been death by stoning. If this would have happened during some time other than a big festival, like the Passover festival, they might still have stoned him. Because you see that they did that to Stephen a few months later when the Romans weren't around. But here during the Passover time, when so many Jews came to Jerusalem, the Romans were there in force as well. The Romans had their armies there and many soldiers, and the Roman leaders were there too to make sure that this large gathering of Jews didn't get out of hand. So there was no way that the Sanhedrin could just go out and stone Jesus. They would get in big, big trouble for that. That was against the law. And the Jewish leadership themselves would be imprisoned or executed or who knows what. Well, so they needed a Roman conviction to execute. So did they just send Jesus with a few guards to the governor who happened to be in town? The governor was normally stationed in Caesarea over at the coast, but for a big Jewish festival where there were lots of Jews, the governor would be there to take care of matters with such a large crowd, right? So Luke 23 verse 1, it says, then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. Okay, so they didn't just send him with a few guards, but they all went. The whole Sanhedrin and all the Jewish leaders that were there went in mass to the governor's mansion, okay, and saw Pilate, the governor Pilate, to present their case to him. Now, a little bit about Pilate to help understand the story here with Pilate, because he's so central to what we're going to talk about today. You need to understand a little bit of background, okay? Pilate, Why a governor? You know, we have like King Herod up in the north, and before him, his dad, Herod the Great, had been king of all of Palestine. So why did we have a governor here? Well, when Herod the Great died, Palestine was divided between his sons, Herod Archelaus, Herod Antipas, and Herod Philip. Okay? Herod Archelaus was the one who was assigned and who received the territory in the south, which included Judea, okay, which is where Jerusalem is, in that area. Also Samaria, that kind of area too. Archelaus was only 18 years old when he took over, and he not only didn't know how to lead, but he was a bad and ruthless leader. And as a result, he was deposed by Rome. And Romans kicked him out and decided, rather than putting another king in place, they just put a governor in place, a prefect. We see reference to this back when Jesus was a baby. If you go back to Matthew chapter 2, if you remember when Herod the Great threatened and wanted to kill Jesus and had all the baby boys in Bethlehem killed, Joseph was warned in a dream, and he and Mary and the baby went down to Egypt. And then picking up in verse 19, after Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up and take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead." Okay, so you see, Herod had died. So they headed back to Israel. He got up and took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee and went and lived in a town called Nazareth. And so it was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, that he will be called a Nazarene. So we see that Joseph and Mary, they had set up home in Bethlehem, and that would have naturally been the place that they would have gone back to. But since Herod Archelaus was so ruthless and evil and was in charge of the southern area, they decided to go back to their hometown where they had come from before, and that is Nazareth up in Galilee. Okay? Alright, so Archelaus was replaced by prefects or by governors, and they would rule for a while and then have a new one, just like our governors rule for a while and we get a new governor. Pilate was the fifth prefect. Okay, he ruled for 10 years. He was definitely an Italian, definitely a Roman. He grew up and was from the hills outside of Rome. His family name was Pontius. Okay, so today we might say Pilate Pontius. But, you know, there they called it Pontius Pilate. Said the family name first. Now, he didn't like the Jews. He didn't understand them, didn't make any sense to them. And by the time we get to today's story, he's had three major incidents with them that are kind of weighing heavy on the way that he approaches his interactions with the Jews. The first one, strike one, is the affair of the Roman standards. Okay? Standards, by the way, are poles that have medallions on top instead of flags. Okay? Like you see, you know, we have flag bearers. Well, the Romans, instead of having flags, would have these medallions on top of the poles that would, and people would carry those walking in front of the army or walking before whatever, just like we would do with a flag today. Now, like I said, the governor's mansion, the governor's headquarters were in Caesarea, and the governor would go and travel through his territory, travel through Palestine once each year and visit the various towns or at least the bigger cities. Now, when other prefects did that, they would remove the eagles and Caesar's image from those medallions or from those standards before they came into Jerusalem, because Caesar was a god, right? And that was a major affront to the Jews. So rather than stirring the pot, other prefects would take those off the poles. Well, Pilate, being new to this, hey, I'm in charge, I'll do what I think is right, and I give honor to Caesar, so he refused to take those medallions off of those standards. As a result, the Jews demonstrated. They protested for 5 days, for, you know, a business week. And they eventually went into this amphitheater and gave a mass surrender. Well, Pilate couldn't kill all the Jews. Okay, that's not what he was there for anyway. So he relented when they had this mass surrender, and he took those standards, the medallions off the poles. Okay? So there was a strike one. One item where he had had this altercation with the Jews because he didn't understand them, he didn't like them, he didn't really care. But he was in charge of them. He was responsible for them. The second strike was this aqueduct construction. Okay? They needed more water in Jerusalem, and there was water in Bethlehem not far away. So He wanted to build this aqueduct. And to be honest, the Jewish leaders agreed because they wanted the water too. So some of the money from the temple funds were provided to Pilate to help build this aqueduct. And the people heard about it and they resented it. This is money that should come from the Romans and not from the temple. And so they rioted. Well, Pilate's reaction to that was swift and mean. He put plainclothes soldiers in the streets and then at a given signal had them attack the crowd. So it was a savage bloodshed of citizens. Okay? And so, but that was the way Romans reacted, is they would react with force very quickly and boldly so that something like this wouldn't happen again. But here we see another, he just doesn't understand the importance of the temple funds and the importance of things that are dedicated to God's use should not be used for Roman use. Okay. The third strike was this votive shields situation. And he had some golden shields made and hung in Herod's palace in Jerusalem. There was a palace that Herod would go to and other visiting dignitaries would come to and stay in Jerusalem. And he had these shields made and hung, just like pictures or whatever. Okay, no big deal. There were no images on it, so it's not like the images of Caesar that we and the eagles that we had up and with the Roman standards. But they were engraved with dedications to the Caesar. Well, that shouldn't be a problem. And in fact, this isn't out in the public. This is in Herod's palace where the Jews really didn't go. But the Jews heard about it and they protested. The one who protested the most too was Herod. Okay, Herod Antipas came to this palace and he saw those and he didn't feel it was right. And so he told Pilate, "I don't want those there." And Pilate said, "No, those are there. They're for Caesar." And Pilate refused to take them down. So Herod and the Jews sent a formal protest to Tiberius, the Caesar at the time. Tiberius sent a response back to Pilate and ordered him to remove the shields and to learn how to respect the Jews and the Jewish customs. Okay, that was obviously offensive to the Jews. You shouldn't have done it. And when they pointed it out to you, you should have taken them down. Okay, so he got scolded by Tiberius. So he's got three strikes against him. Okay, fourth strike, he's out of there, right? All this time, the governor hears about this, and so, or the Caesar hears about it, and so you see his reaction here. Well, there was a strike four. And this happened after today's story. Okay, about 3 years after Jesus was killed. Okay, you have this Samaritan massacre. And there was a false prophet who promised to uncover sacred vessels hidden by Moses on Mount Gerizim. Mount Gerizim is the mountain in Samaria that the Samaritans believed was the holy mountain instead of Mount Zion where Jerusalem is. So the Samaritans gathered at Mount Gerizim to watch, and some of the people brought weapons along with them. Well, shame on them, but they did. Pilate heard about that, and he ordered his troops to attack, and he slaughtered the crowd. Okay, it wasn't just going and rounding up the people with weapons, but he slaughtered these people. Okay, the Samaritans naturally complained to Caesar. Caesar ordered Pilate to return to Rome. Okay, you're fired, you come back, and we're going to talk. And when you talk with Caesar, it's usually not a good thing. Okay, on something like this. Well, lucky for Pilate, while he was en route, Tiberius died. So we think that he just ended up going back home and retired and lived out the rest of his life in his hometown area outside the hills of Rome. Okay? So that's the story of Pontius Pilate and recognizing his background with today's situation, you get a better feel for some of the thinking that he might be going through as this man is brought to him by the Jewish leaders. Okay, he's got three strikes. This is before the Samaritan massacre. It's after those other three strikes. He's got three strikes. He's been reprimanded by the Caesar, by the king of Rome, the emperor of Rome, and told to be more sensitive to the customs and the needs of the Jews. But yet he's in charge, right? And he wants to make sure that he's in charge. So that's the background here. Now the assembly then of the Sanhedrin all leaves in force, we saw in Luke 23, verse 1, to take Jesus to Pilate. Because they need Pilate to execute him, right? Well, when they get to the governor's palace, it's called the Praetorium, and they don't go in. Why not? John 18, verse 28. Then the Jews led Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, the Jews did not enter the palace. They wanted to be able to eat the Passover. Okay? They haven't been that concerned about keeping their laws and doing things right. But here you see another example of one of the little things that, they don't want to defile themselves by going into the palace of the Gentile ruler. Okay? Because they want to be able to continue to celebrate the Feast of Unleavened Bread. You've got this whole week of feasting, and they don't want to be unclean and not be able to do that. So they show up at the governor's mansion here, and it's early in the morning, and Pilate gets up and he hears about all these people coming, all the Jewish leaders are coming with this guy. How quickly does he find out how serious this first case is here? Verse 29. So Pilate came out to them and asked, "All right, what are the charges that you're bringing against this man?" "If he weren't a criminal," they replied, "we wouldn't have handed him over to you." Okay. Pilate said, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone," the Jews objected. So this happened so that the words that Jesus had spoken indicating the kind of death he was going to die would be fulfilled. Okay, Jesus had said before that the Son of Man would be lifted up. And that was talking about his form of death. So they asked for the death penalty. That's a very serious charge that they've got against him. These Jewish leaders feel that this guy needs to die. They can't do it themselves, okay, because they don't have the right, the privilege, the ability to execute someone. But you know, what kind of charge do they have? I said, "Well, trust us, so he's done something wrong," okay? What was their charge? Well, their charge was blasphemy. That's why he had to be killed, right? Well, Pilate wouldn't care about that. Pilate has a life of blaspheming God, right? He doesn't care about Yahweh. So that's not going to be a charge that is going to stick. So what is it that they presented to him? What did they charge Jesus with that Pilate might care about? Well, we'll see that they offered three charges. Luke 23, verse 2. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar. And he claims to be Christ, a king." Okay, three things. He's a revolutionary. He subverts our nation. Okay? He tells people not to pay their taxes. Right? That's not a good thing. The Romans wouldn't like that either, right? And he claims to be a king. He claims to be the Christ, which is a king. Okay, so those were the three charges. When Pilate hears those three charges, were there any of those that were important enough for him to consider more? Back to John 18, starting at verse 33. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" "Is that your idea?" Jesus asked, "or did others talk to you about me?" "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. "It was your people and your chief priests who handed you over to me. So what is it that you've done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now, my kingdom is from another place." "Oh, you are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "Well, you're right in saying that I'm a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of the truth listens to me." "What is truth?" Pilate asks. That's where the big place where he says that. Now you see what Pilate does here is he does what Roman law called for, is he took the accused away from this mob and questioned him privately. Okay, first he asked the mob, he asked the accusers, "Okay, what's the deal here? Okay, what are you accusing him of?" And then he took Jesus in to his private quarters and questioned Jesus privately here and said, "Okay, what's the deal? Are you a king or not?" And you see Jesus' answer is, "My kingdom is not of this world." And he goes, "Okay, so you're a king. You're just not of this world. So you, what is Pilate thinking here? Crazy. Okay. This guy may have a screw loose, but he doesn't appear to be an insurrectionist here, right? Doesn't appear to be someone that we Jews need to worry about, right? What about the other charges? How did Jesus respond to those other the other two charges about being a revolutionary and inciting people not to pay taxes and just the whole situation? Go back to the Matthew verse 11. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Yes, it's as you say," Jesus replied. When he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate asked him, "Don't you hear the testimony that they're bringing against you?" But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. So he kept silent. He kept quiet. He didn't defend himself. And this, we'll see next week, is a fulfillment of messianic prophecies, that he was led like a lamb before the slaughter. And you know, for the Jews, that phrase makes sense, because they dealt with lambs all the time, and they knew how lambs died. But for us city folk, we don't. So I printed for you on the bottom of page 4 a little story that I ran across that I call The Silence of the Lamb. A man had worked for a meat packing firm for many years. He had cut the throats of animals. He had heard the cattle bellow and the fowl squawk and the pig squeal. One day, a farmer brought a lamb to be slaughtered. As usual, the man took his knife and cut the lamb's throat. The lamb didn't squawk, squall, or flounder like other livestock did. It did not bellow and then slump like the cattle. The little lamb just silently stood before the man. With blood flowing from its throat, the lamb tottered towards its executioner, licked the blood from his hands, and began to totter from side to side. Then the lamb silently slumped and slipped into death. The death of that lamb changed the life of that man forever. So how has the slaughter of God's lamb changed your life? Jesus was the silent lamb of God. He did not defend himself in any way. He didn't cry, bellow, or holler, but he went obediently to death as the sacrificial lamb for us. Well, with Jesus not defending himself, with these other charges not seemingly to be a big deal, and plus with his view of Jesus as a king, as well, it's kind of a loony king, or if anything, right? What was Pilate's decision? How was it received? And then, what did he? How did he find a way out? Luke 23, starting at verse 4. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." But they insisted, "He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and he's come all the way here." On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, because Herod Antipas was responsible for the northern part of Galilee, right? When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was in Jerusalem at that time. Okay? So he first, Pilate comes out and says, "I find him not guilty." And the Jews go, "Wrong answer." Okay? They were upset by that. And in their arguments, or in their pursuing Pilate to change his mind, he finds out that Jesus is from Galilee. He goes, "Oh, you know, I can get out of this. I can send him to this guy in charge of Galilee, Herod." Okay? Herod happens to be in town. We'll send him there. So he sends him to Herod. Now, normally Herod would not be in the same place as Pilate. So if this trial were happening and Herod didn't happen to be there, he could have sent Jesus off to Herod, and it could have taken weeks for Jesus to get there. But the fact that Herod was right there, right close by in Herod's palace, you see how God put everything together so it would, his plan would follow through. All right, well, Herod is vacationing during the Passover. Okay, Herod was not a Jew, by the way. He was an Idumean or an Edomite, but he was responsible for the Jews in Galilee. And so he came down to Jerusalem while the Jews were down there. And when Jesus is sent to him, does he feel like this is an imposition? or what? Next verse of Luke 23, verse 8. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he'd been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some miracle. Then verse 12, that day Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. Okay, Herod had longed to see Jesus. He had heard lots of stories about Jesus and the miracles that he performs, and he wanted to see a magic act. And when Pilate sent Jesus to Herod, Herod was greatly pleased, it says. So as a result, that kind of built a little friendship between the two. It broke down the walls of animosity between those two, between Pilate and Herod. Besides wanting to see a miracle, there's something else that really made Herod excited to see Jesus. Matthew chapter 14, verses 1 and 2. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch heard the reports about Jesus. And he said to his attendants, "This is John the Baptist. He's risen from the dead. That's why miraculous powers are at work in him." He wondered if Jesus might be the John the Baptist that he had killed, raised from the dead. And you can go on and read further into Matthew 14. It tells a story about Herod executing John the Baptist. He really didn't want to do that, but his wife drove him to do so. Luke 9:9, the same verse that we just read in Matthew, says that he tried to see Jesus. He wanted to see Jesus to find out, could this be John the Baptist? Because Herod was interested in John. Now, when John was imprisoned, Herod would call him in and listen to him because he was entertaining. So now Jesus has come. He's heard about his power and his miracles. He wants to see some magic. But he also is curious, could this be John the Baptist? Well, he's got Jesus before him. How does it turn out? Does Herod take care of this Jesus situation as Pilate had hoped? Luke 23, starting at verse 9. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there vehemently accusing him. Oh, then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. Okay. So he tried to get Jesus to talk like John the Baptist had talked, but he didn't. Jesus was silent like a lamb led before the slaughter. He tried to get Jesus to perform some magic acts. He wouldn't. So finally Herod just got frustrated and mocked him, you know, and put on his robe and said, "Okay, you're king of the Jews, here you go." That kind of thing. Just kind of make a joke out of it and send him back to Pilate. Okay, so he didn't take care of the problem. But you see, he also didn't condemn. He didn't condemn Jesus to death. He didn't see that Jesus was worthy of death, but he also didn't really support Jesus either. It was just some lunatic guy, right? All right, so he's back with Pilate now. How does Pilate try a third time to resolve this situation of a mob against an innocent man? Verse 13. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, and said to them, "Okay, you brought me this man as one who is inciting the people to rebellion. I've examined him in your presence, and I found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us, as you can see. He's done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I'll punish him, and then I'll release him." Okay? Said, there's nothing wrong here. This guy hadn't done anything, so if it makes you happy, I'll flog him, I'll beat him up, I'll punish him, and then I'll release him because he's an innocent man. Okay, so he's at least trying to appease the bloodthirsty crowd here. So he offered to do that, but that's not what they wanted, right? They wanted him executed. So when that didn't work, what idea did Pilate have? Verse 15 of Matthew 27. Now it was the governor's custom at the feast to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked him, "All right, which one do you want me to release to you? Barabbas or Jesus who's called Christ?" For he knew it was out of envy that they had handed Jesus over to him. Okay, he tries to make them make a hard decision here. Because they're just jealous of this guy. There's something they don't like about this guy. But just because you don't like him, would you rather have this guy you don't like or a murderer? someone who is a known murderer to put that people will be in danger. So he offers them that choice. So how well did that idea work? Verse 20. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. Which of the two do you want me to release to you? Asked the governor. Barabbas, they answered. Well, what shall I do then with Jesus, who's called the Christ? Pilate asked. They all answered, crucify him. Why? What crime has he committed? Asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, crucify him. It backfired. This plan that he had of offering Jesus or Barabbas backfired. And he really sees how serious these guys are about wanting Jesus to be executed. Okay, they demanded the crucifixion of Jesus. Now this crowd, you know, we've talked about it before. You take a look at just a few days earlier, Jesus came into Jerusalem with great shouts of praise on Palm Sunday. Every day he would show up in the temple and crowds would flock around him, wanting to see him, wanting to touch him, wanting to hear him. How could the crowd turn against him? Because it's not the same crowd. This crowd is composed of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish leaders, their supporters, the ones who want Jesus dead. The others, where are they? They're still at home, or they're still in their hotels, or they're wherever they were staying for the Passover. They had a big meal the night before. Okay? It's early in the morning. 7 o'clock, maybe 8 at the latest. Okay? People are not out yet. So, he's got a crowd here that definitely wants this man executed. But Pilate's responsibility is to uphold justice. And this man is innocent. Why would you execute an innocent man? And on top of that, what else bothered Pilate about going along with the crowd? Verse 19. While Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message. Don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him. Okay? Omens were big for the Romans. And there was a bad omen. His wife had had a nightmare about Jesus and had sent him a warning not to do anything with him. Well, we see he ends up doing something with him, and what happens today? Today in our creed we say he suffered under Pontius Pilate. Everybody knows the name of Pontius Pilate. Why? Because he had something to do with this man. He had the opportunity to release Jesus, but he didn't. He condemned an innocent man to death. But it was a death that saves all of us. Right? Well, so what did Pilate then do to try to appease this bloodthirsty crowd? Okay, they obviously want blood of this man. And he had offered to have him beaten. They didn't care. He'd offered this murderer in exchange for Jesus, and they wanted the murderer. So what does he do? John 19. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. And when they had him flogged, we'll talk about this more, they beat him to shreds. They use a whip that have nails and pieces of bone tied in them, and the floggers are proud of hitting bone, of tearing the skin all the way. A lot of people would die just from the flogging. So Pilate had Jesus flogged. And then the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again saying, Hail, King of the Jews! And they struck him in the face. Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews, Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him. Then when Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to him, Here's the man. Okay? He had offered to have him beaten, and they didn't care. Well, now he went ahead and had him beaten. And brought him back out, totally tortured, totally beaten. Okay, now maybe these people will see the blood, will see that this guy has got his just reward for whatever it is that they've got against him, and that'll satisfy him. Okay, so he puts the beaten Jesus in front of them to see, okay, here you go. Are you satisfied? So were they satisfied? Next verses. As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, Crucify! Crucify! Pilate answered, You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him. The Jews insisted, we have a law, and according to that law, he must die, because he claimed to be the Son of God. There's the bottom line. That was the charge they had against him. That's what they really cared about. Okay? He claimed to be God. And if you truly believe that he was not God, then you'd have to side with these Jewish leaders, because God tells you that if someone claims to be God, if someone blasphemes God, they deserve death. But they didn't have the right to execute. Now here, Pilate's kind of saying, you go ahead and crucify him. Okay? Well, they didn't crucify. They stoned to death. All right? That didn't satisfy him. Well, does Pilate then say, okay, you said so? He's obviously not going to get anywhere with this crowd. He's beat the tar out of Jesus. He's had him tortured, and yet they're still not satisfied. They want him dead. So does he give up and then sentence Jesus upon this realization of their determination? Next verses. When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid. And he went back inside the palace. Where do you come from? He asked Jesus. Okay, so he's got Jesus privately with him again. Where do you come from? But Jesus gave him no answer. Do you refuse to speak even to me? Pilate said, don't you realize that I have power either to free or crucify you? Jesus answered, you would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin. So you see, he goes in and he takes Jesus in further, trying to get to the bottom of this. He's trying to understand, why is this such a big deal? What is it that Jesus really did? Just because he claims to be God, big deal. Okay? People say all sorts of stuff, and he's a lunatic or whatever. What is it that he really did? What's the deal? He's trying to get to the bottom of it. But then Jesus doesn't defend himself. He's like that lamb before a slaughter. And Paul goes, don't you realize that I could either free you or crucify you? And then Jesus kind of stands up to him and says, you only have the power that was given to you by my Father. What makes matters even worse? Okay? Verse 12, from then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free. He keeps trying. He's look how much he's already gone over and above trying to set this innocent man free. He cannot see why this man should die. He tries, but then the Jews kept shouting, if you let this man go, you are no friend to Caesar. Anyone who claims to be king opposes Caesar. Oh. Now those are big words. Those are big words that Pilate has to respond to. Jesus claims to be king, is their accusation. Well, he knows he's not claiming to be that kind of king. But yet, what's happened before? These Jewish leaders have found that they can send letters to Tiberius and get Pilate in trouble. And Pilate's already in trouble. And he's in trouble for not being sensitive to their needs and sensitive to their customs and sensitive to their religious ways. This is one of those customs and religious ways. Pilate doesn't understand it. But they're pushing him. And they push him and say, you are no friend to Caesar if you let this guy go. Whoa. Those are big words. So what's Pilate going to do? How does he react to this threat? Verse 13. When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as a stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of Passover week. In other words, it's a Friday. Fridays is the day of preparation before the Sabbath. Okay, so it's Friday. About the sixth hour. Now, one note on that sixth hour, because we're going to talk about timing next week. The Jews counted time from sunup. Okay, so the sixth hour would be like noon. The Romans, however, counted time from like midnight. So the sixth hour would be six in the morning. So the thought is that this is referring to Roman time, which would be six in the morning. Going on. Here is your king, Pilate said to the Jews. Okay, so he presents Jesus as their king. Okay, you say he's the king of the Jews? Okay, this is your king. But they shouted, take him away, crucify him. Shall I crucify your king? Pilate said. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priest answered. Okay. So Pilate tries to throw it in their face a little bit. Okay, you're saying that I'm no friend of Caesar because he claims to be king. This is your king. He says he's king of the Jews. This is your king. You brought him to me. Okay. And that just gets them even madder, and they shout even louder to crucify him. Well, Pilate's stuck between a rock and a hard place. He's got this innocent man that does not deserve to die. He's already flogged him and beaten him nearly to death for who knows what. Pilate doesn't know what. Okay, just because he's got these people upset with him. He knows it's wrong to send an innocent man to death. But yet, he can't satisfy this crowd any other way, and that crowd is sending threatening messages to him that he's going to get in trouble with Tiberius if he doesn't do something here. So what does he decide to do? Matthew 27, verse 24. When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. "I'm innocent of this man's blood," he said. "It's your responsibility." All the people answered, "Let his blood be on us and on our children." And then he released Barabbas to them, but he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. He did it. He went through with sentencing Jesus to be executed. Could he have stopped the execution? Absolutely. It was in his power. But he found that to be dangerous to his own position. Just like the Jews found Jesus to be dangerous to their position. Just like we sometimes might find Jesus to be dangerous to our position with other people. How often are you hesitant in sharing your faith with other people? With your friends and neighbors and co-workers and those that God puts before you? Are you afraid that you might be embarrassed? Okay? Look what it's driven the chief priests and leaders to do. Look what it's driven Pilate to do. Look what it's driven us to do. Pilate was not the only one who put Jesus on the cross. You take a look at the chief priests, the leaders, the Jews there. They put Jesus on the cross. But they also were not the only ones. You did it. I did it. We put Jesus on that cross. Let's pray. God our Father, we thank you for giving us these lessons so that we can see ourselves more in them. We see that we are like Pilate, that we are like Annas, we are like the Jewish leaders. We find it more important to retain our position or retain ourselves and focus on ourselves than to stand up for you. We ask you to forgive us for that. We thank and praise you that you sent your Son, even though we turn from you, that you never turn from us. And you sent your Son to die for us. Even though we don't deserve it in the least. So that we in turn could be your people and come to you and live eternally with you. Keep us mindful of that as we continue to remember what you did for us through your Son. In his name we pray. Amen.